Now let's listen to NBC's reporter Peter Tompkins in Athens, Greece.
Attacks on the British-Greek line of defense have been utter failures. I'm afraid I can't give any real details on the fighting, because there simply aren't any I can trust as being reliable. I hear a million stories daily of what's going on up the front, but I seldom hear the same story twice. And British headquarters here aren't giving out any communiques. What I can tell, though, is that so far things are working out okay. The RAF, too, is a big help. But of course, the big German attack hasn't really started yet. The last Greek communique on the situation at the front says merely restricted local activity. But I have got some fresh news from Yugoslavia. I just spoke to some Yugoslav soldiers who arrived from the South Serbian front tonight. They confirmed the stories of how the Yugoslav army there was forced to retreat. We were still on the move towards our positions when the Germans attacked, they told me. We hadn't even taken up our positions. All of a sudden, the sky was black with German bombers. They messed up all our communications. We were cut off from everyone else. Then they came at us with their tanks. We never even had time to know what had happened. They also told me of the hair-raising exploits of the famous Chetnitsi. Chetnitsi are Serbian peasants who are looked up to by all the other peasants. They wear a special dress, a sort of fur cap and shoes that turn up at the end. In peacetime, they're always armed. It's odd to see them with their cartridge belts around their waist. In wartime, they give their lives for their country. They don't wear uniforms and so can't be taken by the enemy. They'd be shot immediately. Their flag is black with a skull and crossbones. They know they have to die and they expect it. In wartime, they live a wild life. They hide out in the woods and come out when there's a chance to get the enemy. It was these men who slipped up on the German tanks outside Skopje and Gevgeli. They slipped up on the tanks and threw them up with hand grenades, the way the famous Dinamiteros did during the Spanish War. They say 80 German tanks were ruined outside Skopje and 50 more near Gevgeli. But the important thing I learned from these Serbian soldiers is that it was the German Luftwaffe that made the German attack so successful. The sky was simply black with planes, they said. Planes cut us off from the other divisions, and then the tanks came in. They came in the usual German method. Tanks followed by motorized divisions, with the infantry and heavy stuff coming up behind. These superior Serbian officers all agreed, though, that their army can retire to the Montenegrin mountains and give the Germans plenty of worry. All we worry about, they said, is that the British and the U.S. can get supplies to us by sea. Oh, I nearly forgot to tell you about the Serbian captain near Stip, who found a hiding place in which he could knock off one German tank after the other. He was finally picked up by a Stuka and blown to pieces. Another proof that the German Air Force, which hasn't yet been used on a wide scale against Greece, was one of the main factors in the German success in southern Yugoslavia. These Serbian officers also emphasized the part played by fifth column elements in the government. We were forced to string out our forces over the entire length of our frontiers, they told me. The Croats said they wanted to be defended too. That's what prevented us from forming a decent front along our natural defenses. We weren't allowed to. And then most of the Croats deserted anyhow. They simply refused to fight. But we'll show the Germans yet. And here in Athens, the first Greek soldiers who were wounded along the Vardar Valley have come back. They say the Germans aren't really so wonderful. They bleed like anyone else if you stick a bayonet in them, said one young Greek who'd lost his arm. And then he added, they're not invincible. With the right material, we can lick them all right. I went to see the first German prisoners who arrived in Athens. They're a sullen lot. They don't say anything. They just snap to attention and give the Nazi salute when they see an officer. And as for the Italians, right next to them, they won't even nod to them. The way they look at each other, there doesn't seem to be much love lost between the Axis members. Most of the Germans were infantry, captured by the Greeks in the Rupel Pass. There are lots of parachutists, too. There are also five aviators. They have an idea they'll be set free when the Germans get to Athens. But the British here seem to be equally confident that they won't get here. And they mean it, I think. That's all tonight.
Ladies and gentlemen, We started our regular Sunday evening news roundup rather abruptly tonight because Peter Tompkins in Athens had already started his report. He started his report by the clock in the Athens studio, and that clock was approximately 30 seconds fast. We had planned to bring you tonight a report from the Balkans with Martin Agranski. Ladies and gentlemen, weather conditions across the Atlantic are too bad to attempt a communication with neutral Turkey. So now, we have a bulletin from the NBC newsroom in New York, a dispatch from Moscow. Soviet Russia and Japan today signed a 5-year treaty of non-aggression and mutual friendship, rendering secure the Japanese Empire's back door in Eastern Asia. In effect, it is granting Japan a free hand for southward expansion, notwithstanding American and British opposition. This pact forges the final link in the chain of Russia's diplomatic associations with the Italian, German, Japanese New Order, and possibly dooms China's fight of nearly 4 years against the Japanese invasion. In the presence of Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin, Russia's Premier and Foreign Commissar Molotov placed his signature on the document in behalf of the USSR, and the Foreign Minister Matsuoka, he signed for Japan. Ranking in worldwide significance with the Soviet-German Non-Aggression Accord of August of 1939, which was the prelude to the European War, the Russo-Japanese Pact embraces four principal points. And these four principal points are this. 1, Russia and Japan agree to maintain peaceful and friendly relations toward each other and to respect the integrity and the inviolability of each other's territory, including Manchukuo, the Japanese-conquered Chinese northern provinces, which Russia now recognizes as Japan's possession. 2, in the event either of the contracting powers becomes the object of military action by one or more third powers, the other party will observe neutrality throughout the entire period of the resultant conflict. 3, the treaty is to become effective immediately for a period of 5 years. 4, the Soviet Union and Japan, by joint declaration, pledge themselves specifically to respect the territorial integrity not only of Japan and the USSR proper, but also of the Japanese-controlled Empire of Manchukuo and the Soviet-dominated Republic of Outer Mongolia. Having thus crowned his career by successfully concluding an amity treaty with Japan's traditional foe and most formidable rival of the Asiatic continent, the Foreign Minister Matsuoka left Moscow by special train 3 hours after the Kremlin signed ceremonies and the history-making pact was in his briefcase. He thereby brought to an end a 3-week journey which carried him through Moscow to Berlin, then to Rome, where he conferred with Hitler and Benito Mussolini, who for months encouraged a formal Soviet-Japanese reconciliation, and then back to Moscow to negotiate the treaty in the 5 days of bargaining. In Tokyo, the Japanese government issued a joint Russian-Japanese communique announcing the conclusion of the pact. The Japanese Prince Kanoi quickly hailed the treaty as natural, a natural alliance with Germany and Italy, saying, "It is not only of epoch-making significance in the Russian-Japanese relations, but will also hasten world peace." In Berlin, responsible German quarters declared the Soviet-Tokyo Pact completely changes the situation in the Far East and will free Japan's hands to concentrate on pursuing the new order policies in the Far East in face of Anglo-American opposition. Berlin sources said, "It will pull the props from under China's Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek, and has ended any prospects the United States may have of maneuvering Moscow into an anti-Japanese move." The Far Eastern diplomatic observers in Shanghai said the Soviet-Japanese treaty may be the green light for great events in the Pacific. In London, the official circles declined to comment, pending the receipt and fuller study of the details of the accord as signed in Moscow. The Soviet-Japanese Covenant, following friendship between two major powers that have fought each other on numerous times in the Far East since the Russian-Japanese War of 1904, was regarded by the foreign diplomatic circles in Moscow as having two underlying principles: to permit Japan to concentrate her major attentions on the swiftly terminating of her long and costly war in China, and to allow Russia to concentrate major attention on problems of the Balkans. Now, ladies and gentlemen, let's listen to Balkage, reporting from our NBC newsroom in Washington.
On an Easter Sunday, robed in the springtime beauty of Bodden Tree, the avenues down here filled with one of the largest crowds of peacetime visitors this capital has ever seen. Actually, the White House lawn this afternoon looked like a college campus on class day. But official Washington has its mind on something else besides entertaining. Two things, of course, stand out in the day's news as of vital concern to the United States. One is the signing of the Russo-Japanese Neutrality Pact in Moscow, which you've just heard described in detail. And the other is the latest repercussion of Denmark's repudiation of the agreement signed by the president and the Danish minister, under which, as you know, the United States takes over the protection of Greenland. A little while ago, I spoke with the Danish minister, Mr. de Kaufmann, at the Danish legation. He has had no further communication officially from his government since he received the telegram late yesterday, signed by his foreign office, which, as you know, recalled him from his post. But he told me that tomorrow, when he sees Secretary of State Hull, he will present a note stating his views. And probably that note will contain the explanation of his signing of the pact without instructions from Copenhagen. Really an unheard-of proceeding in diplomatic protocol. But as he said to me today in his suave and cultured English, in an earnest voice, with a sincerity that you couldn't miss, these are times of an emergency. If it had not been for the extraordinary circumstances, I, of course, never would have thought of signing such an agreement without consulting my government. But I acted as I thought for the true interest of my country. As you know, the Germans and now later the Danes, the Danish government in Copenhagen, has declared the agreement illegal. But the opinion in official quarters here is that the validity of the instrument rests, after all, with the United States. In Danish circles, of course, the fact is accepted that the Copenhagen government there makes its statement under duress, since all of the royal family and the members of the parliament are virtually prisoners in an occupied country. In view of the week's developments, the question has arisen naturally as to whether there is a possibility that the Danish government in exile or some other instrument be set up of that nature, but the legation does not believe so. Nevertheless, there clings to the memory of man the ancient saying that a forced oath is not an oath, and by analogy, the order of a captive state cannot exactly be considered an order. Of course, if the Germans should force the Danes to resist the establishment of bases in Greenland, that might involve direct measures for the United States. And it's also possible that this country may sever relations with the present Danish government anyway. As you know, the American minister was withdrawn from Copenhagen some time ago. The signing of the Russo-Japanese News Pact has evoked official comment here from Chairman Bloom of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He says it has no real significance, that it is meaningless because the signers have not kept faith in the past with what they have signed. However, other legislators have expressed concern privately that Japan might now feel free to move against British possessions in the Pacific. Both this event and the rejection of the agreement over Greenland may be affected, of course, by the developments in Yugoslavia. And in this connection, Washington today is asking itself the same question that many others throughout the world may be asking. Was the government here, the high officials supposed to know all that could be known about what is going on abroad? Were they unprepared for the speed with which the Germans advanced as far as they did? Well, the answer is yes. Now, some military observers here did feel that the Allied position was weaker than others believed it was. But no one in close touch with the White House believes that the president knowingly yielded to pressure politics and offered Yugoslavia and Greece aid which he did not believe would be delivered in time to help them. And that raises the question, why was the government not better informed? Well, two reasons are being offered. First, that some persons, our observers abroad, perhaps were misled by wishful thinkers who thought the gesture might provide necessary morale. Or else, our observers were unable to separate falsely circulated rumors from facts. That is the way the situation stands. I see my time is up. So that's all for the moment from Washington. Thanks very much.
Are you ready? London.
This is John McVane in London. Today was a quiet Easter Sunday in London. Londoners who had the chance went away for the day or the weekend to the country, or to visit relatives in the small provincial villages. For many, the day provided a chance to visit children evacuated to the country, children whom they haven't seen for weeks or months. Travel was discouraged because the railroads were needed to move essential war materials, even on Easter. But in spite of that, London streets were much quieter than on ordinary Sundays. Churches in the city were crowded at every service, and services were broadcast at various intervals during the day, beginning at 7 in the morning. On this Easter night, there have been no bombs reported on Britain. Some single planes came over the coast and were said to be over East Anglia in the southwest. Walking to the NBC office early tonight, I suddenly saw a score of searchlights strike up into the night sky. From three sides of the compass, they began to weave back and forth. You could imagine the hunt for a tiny, unseen dot miles high in the night. Some of the lights hunted in pairs. As you turned into the office, half a dozen met in an arch of brilliance over your head. Unconsciously, you began to listen for the drone of the plane. Then the beams of light separated and winked out. And you remembered, suddenly, that it was Easter night. Dispatches reaching London from Egypt confirmed that the Germans have occupied Bardia, and that fighting has reached the neighborhood of the Egyptian frontier port of Solum. It is pointed out that the German mechanized column that entered Bardia swept around to a brook. Bardia had been evacuated by the British. Reports deny that Tobruk is surrounded and isolated, and says that a mechanized column can make contact. British units seem to be moving back to Egypt from a town in East Africa, and the situation is said to be better than it was a week ago. The German tanks and trucks are said to be getting their gasoline supplies by air, and their casualties are thought to have been heavy. It was learned in London today that the Yugoslavs are putting up hard resistance to the Germans. In the Nis region of Serbia, the Yugoslavs have counterattacked on both sides of the Morava River, have recaptured Prokuplje, and now control a big area west of the river. Near Belgrade, a German armored force is said to have been cut off and isolated. In the south, the Yugoslavs are continuing their advance against the Italians in Albania. German troops tried to head off the thrust, but are said to have been driven back. The Yugoslavs are working in small independent formations, operating from the mountains. Only patrol activity is reported from the Monastir Gap region that separates Greece and Yugoslavia. A message from Mr. Churchill was broadcast from London tonight to the Yugoslav people. He expressed his faith in the Yugoslav victory and the sympathy of the British people for the Yugoslavs. The British Empire is fighting with you, Mr. Churchill concluded. And behind us is the great democracy of the United States with its vast and ever-increasing resources. News that Russia and Japan have signed a treaty of friendship hasn't made any noticeable impression in British official circles. The treaty, signed by Mr. Molotov and Mr. Matsuoka, simply pledges the two countries to peaceful relations and provides that if one country is impelled to war by a third power, the other signatory will keep strict neutrality. Japan recognizes Russian control of northern Mongolia, and Russia recognizes Japanese control of Manchukuo. British observers fail to find any special significance in the treaty. If either side is the gainer, it is thought to be Russia, but the wording of the treaty is so general as to seem practically meaningless. Treaties seem to have less and less meaning these days. A few months ago, Hungary pledged peace and friendship with Yugoslavia, and now Hungarian troops are attacking Yugoslavian troops. Possibly today's treaty is just a little gesture by Russia to give Mr. Matsuoka the satisfaction of going home with something to show his countrymen for his long travels. Russia can well afford the gesture because, as regards Japan, she has little to lose. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
Next, news of the North African campaign from Grant Parr, our reporter accredited to the British Middle East Command. Go ahead, Cairo.
This is Grant Parr speaking from Cairo, Egypt. A war on two fronts, the old nightmare of Prussian strategists, may sometimes be an advantage today. In fact, Germany's central position helped her to beat Poland and routed half her panzer divisions to the west before France got started. It all depends on the timing. Italy once occupied such a central position in East Africa. Despite the difficulty of communications there, he was able to mass enough troops to force the British out of British Somaliland. The Italians collapsed in East Africa because they were outfought, but the strategic advantage was chiefly theirs. Today, Britain finds herself in the center, in the Middle East, like the rim of a great wheel, the front circle around us here in Cairo. For Cairo is the hub. German forces are pushing down from Bulgaria. German and Italian cones are trying to thrust further into Cyrenaica. Bands of uncaptured Italians keep certain British forces occupied in Abyssinia. To all these problems, British mobility and strategy must be the solution. General Sir Archibald Wavell, take the reports as they come to him here, then send them where they are needed, a step ahead of the enemy. When Italian eyes were on Cyrenaica, General Wavell uncorked the drive on Karen. Ildice hadn't expected it so soon, any more than the original British attack on Cyrenaica had been anticipated. Naturally, the efforts of the Axis have been directed at spoiling the British timing. This was the basis of Italy's supportive attack on Greece, which was supposed to draw Royal Air Force and Navy strength from Cyrenaica. Finally, German penetration into Bulgaria threatened Greece and Yugoslavia. British troops had to be sent to Greece. Hence, the Germans launched their drive on Cyrenaica. Some believe that here the timing of General Wavell, hitherto almost faultless, slipped off gear and fell behind. The Germans did move when East Africa was still an unfinished campaign, when the need for men in Greece was urgent. But there is another way of looking at it. If the Germans wanted to save East Africa, they were 3 weeks late themselves. Growing Patriot forces and South Africans can now cope with the Italians in Abyssinia, and British regulars, Indians, and free French are available for fighting in Greece, Cyrenaica, or wherever they are needed. The Middle East also regards President Roosevelt's recent shipping proclamation as well-timed. Direct shipments of supplies from America to Egypt will be a possibly decisive aid to Britain, Greece, and Yugoslavia. German mechanized forces have now detoured around Tobruk and taken Bardia, from which British troops were previously evacuated. Fighting is raging around Saloon and at Tobruk, which the British still hold, the Germans have been repulsed. Yet it can still fairly be said that in the lightning movements of desert warfare such as this, no one can immediately identify victor or vanquished. This battle, like the larger one of the Middle East, is also a matter of timing. Meanwhile, the Royal Air Force is up to its old tricks. British flyers are in the air day and night over Cyrenaica, destroying the Axis birds in their nests. Picture the scene at Derna Aerodrome a few nights ago. The field is covered with German Messerschmitt fighters, too many to be moved when the alarm sounds. The black crosses on the machines stand up clearly in the bright African moonlight. The wings even cast shadows. Yet the deceptive light shows nothing in the sky. Suddenly a faint hum of motors is heard. The hum becomes a roar, a scream. British and free French fighters are diving, seemingly out of the moon. Machine guns are rattling now, and their impacts evoke a web of dust puffs over the entire field. Then come other noises, the crackle and rattle of lead striking wood and metal. There is a sharp explosion, and a Messerschmitt disintegrates. Another bursts into flames, and another. More bullets thud down, and even the dust handicaps the frantic ground crew. Along one runway, a big Junkers dive bomber roars forward for a takeoff. But a British fighter breaks away from its flight and dies. Little dust puffs move toward the runway, cross it as the Junkers passes. The Junkers wobbles like a hurt bird, skids, rolls over and over. Smoke pours from the wreck, then a tongue of flame. On the ground and in the air, 21 German planes were destroyed in that one raid. This is Grant Parr returning you to the NBC.
You have just heard the news as reported by Grant Parr, our reporter accredited to the British Middle East Command, speaking to us tonight from Cairo. And now, in just a moment, we'll have news from the Reich. Our speaker from that point will be Charles Lanius. So go ahead, Berlin.
Hello, NBC. This is Charles Lanius in Berlin. German interest tonight swings between the military victories in southeastern Europe and Africa and the new Soviet-Japanese non-aggression pact. The new agreement was signed at the Kremlin in Moscow this afternoon by Japanese Foreign Minister Matsuoka and Soviet Foreign Commissaire Molotov. There are 4 points to the pact, according to the information we have here in Berlin. The first is an assurance of friendship. The second is a declaration of non-aggression. That is to say, if Soviet Russia or Japan is attacked by a third party, the remaining pact partner will remain neutral and take no part in the conflict against the other signer. The third point stipulates that the treaty become effective immediately upon ratification for a period of 5 years, and the fourth clause calls for its rapid ratification by each of the signers. I don't think anyone here is particularly surprised at the announcement that the pact has been signed. During the past week, Matsuoka and Molotov have had several long meetings, each lasting several hours, and it was more or less expected that something would come of them. However, it's a bit too early for official German reaction, and most German officials, who could make authoritative comments, aren't available because of Easter holidays. Some unofficial observers say they believe the pact is aimed at giving Japan a free hand in case of war with the United States. And then there are others who have a different opinion. But the stand of the German government isn't known tonight. It's interesting to note that the signing of the pact comes hard at the heels of a report that the Soviet Union disapproved of the Hungarian attack on Yugoslavia. A message here tonight says the advance of the Hungarian troops into Yugoslavia is speeding up. The Hungarians have apparently taken a leaf from the German military manual and are using parachute troops. The parachutists are said to have captured a number of strategic points, fighting off all attempts of the Yugoslavs to dislodge them until they got relief from their motorized units. According to this report, the Hungarians now control the region of the Bernina Triangle. That's the country bounded by the Danube and Theiss rivers and the Hungarian frontier. Their fast armored detachments are said to have reached Neusatz on the Danube River sometime this morning. The German press is splashing the taking of Belgrade and the recapture of Bardi on the Cyrenaica frontier. Single-sheet extras tell the story in big type, how German mechanized divisions under the command of General von Kleist rolled into Belgrade from the south at 6:30 this morning after SS troops commanded by Captain Klingenberg had fought their way into part of the city from the Danube side late yesterday. Near Zagreb, 22 generals, including 2 army commanders, 300 officers, and 12,000 soldiers threw down their arms before the Germans. Further to the northwest, the German troops have met Italian soldiers who have broken through from the eastern Italian frontier. The latest news from the southeast came through just a short time ago. Today, around noon, German bombers went after military targets at Sarajevo. That's the town that provided the setting for the assassination of an Austrian Archduke, which precipitated the Great War. The German pilots claim direct hits on large military camps, which are said to be between the railway station and the town proper. There's no war news from the south except a report that the German advance is progressing according to plan. A late story put out by the German radio hints that the British are about to make another strategic retreat from Greece. According to the Germans, 8 empty British troop transports have left the Suez Canal toward the north. The Germans say they assume that these ships are on their way to Greek ports to take the place of troop ships destroyed by Stukas, which were to have been used for the re-embarkation of the BEF. This is Charles Lanius in Berlin. I now return you to NBC in New York.
This has been our regular Sunday evening roundup of reports from our staff at home and abroad. Tonight, Peter Tompkins gave us the news in Greece. Balkage summarized the news in Washington. John McVane spoke to us from London. Grant Parr brought us up to date on the North African campaign. And Charles Lanius of our staff in Germany reported the news in the Reich. From Berlin. This is a regular Sunday evening news program of the Blue Network of the National Broadcasting Company.